I do invite a lot of decision makers to make important decisions, make them outside, close to water, with a child, preferably with you, so that you phrase it as simple and understandable that the child can understand. And also, can you look the children into the eye with your decision and be informed with the consequences that it will have beyond that child, for the soil, the water, the air, all the living beings? Because then to realize that the drinkable river for many of our plants, our trees and our fish and birds and even the dogs that we that take on walks, or the cows we have in the fields for us, it's a reality. They already drink from the river.
Hello and welcome to the Inner Green Deal podcast, where we talk to inspiring guests about the human dimension of sustainability and explore the link between our personal journeys and the positive impacts we can have on the world. My name is Tamsin Walker. Before I introduce you to my guest this month, I'd like to invite you to pour yourself a glass of water, maybe to be sipping from as you listen. Because today I'm going to be talking to Lee-Ann Poer. She's founder of the Dutch charity Drinkable Rivers, which is working towards a world with waterways so clean that we can sip from their banks. Lee-Ann's journey started in 2005 when she canoed the full length of the Rupert River in Canada, drinking fresh water from it as she went. When she returned there just 3 years later, the water had been polluted as a result of dams and mining. Fish were dying and local people were falling ill. Lee-Ann realized that being able to drink from a river was an indicator of healthy living. She now raises awareness and mobilizes people to take action through source to sea river walks, citizen science, and community building. She's also co-authored a book, Drinkable Rivers: How the River Became My Teacher. Welcome, Lee-Ann.
Thank you.
I would like to start by asking a question that I ask everybody, and I think it's particularly apt with you because nature seems to be something that's really important to you. So with that in mind, I'd be interested to hear if there was a place that when you were growing up somewhere in nature that was particularly important to you, or somewhere that really fired your imagination.
Yeah, and it wasn't so close to home. Because it wasn't obvious growing up in an urban suburb of Rotterdam. But one that stands out immediately that I'm thinking of when you invite me into this question is the area where my grandparents were living, the parents of my father, and they were living in Zeeland. And there were a lot of dunes there, and they would take me on these walks. They started to notice how much I loved these dunes, that they even called them after me, Lee-Ann's dunes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is very profound. And one other is I was born in the fall, and it is the time of year that still has a lot of colored leaves. And I really loved always to celebrate my birthday in Meijendel, which is the forest close to The Hague. That was just this place where I'd love to climb trees and walk and get lost.
Oh, how nice. I find it very relatable. I think the autumn, the smells that come up from the earth, very old, old smells, and they feel so comforting somehow. I love it too.
Yeah, nice that you say old smells. Yeah, it all intensifies. The storms are more stormy, the rains are more rainy, but when it then is the sun shines, that is then also so bright, and all the colors of the leaves and indeed the smells, yeah, the soil, very present. Yeah.
So water is very much at the heart of your work, and I was wondering if you think that there's any relationship between the direction that you've gone in your work and having grown up in a country where a lot of the land is reclaimed from the sea.
Yeah, if you look at it from where we are now, it makes that obvious link. But that wasn't so obvious and clear that was what was guiding me. It was until I was in actually Northern Canada, where the Cree indigenous are living, They help me to remember that my birthplace is my first teachers. And then I've been staying more at home of where do I come from and what does these places have to teach me. And then I started to be invited more into our waterways and seeing actually, oh, water is one of the wildest elements in our landscape. And I'm actually born in the lowest point of the lowlands.
Okay.
Yeah. So just to imagine indeed like that we, the fact that we could reclaim that, that sort of there's a genius to it, that's possible. There's also an insanity to it as well at the same time.
Yeah.
It's still growing and it's still sinking even. And one of the things that was very clear and a very important encounter was with a gray heron. And of course, they live here because of all the water. They're special creatures. And I had an encounter when I was maybe about 3 or 4 years old. I was at the same eye height as the gray heron. And then I really felt what I would now describe as you can be anywhere. You're so free to be anywhere and you choose to be here. Mm-hmm. This self-willingness of being somewhere, I felt that was starting to define wilderness for me, being so immersed into a suburban area where every centimeter is planned and every tree is recorded in some database. It was quite a contrast to have these free creatures. Mm-hmm. But I do want to say that when you noticed how I'm responding, I never used the word nature. Because I don't want to make nature as if we are not that. Of course, there's discernments, and I understand then the functionality of these words, but I see the trap of how we're using the word nature. So for me, if it's all that is alive, like the gray heron and the moss, then I rather refer to the gray heron and the moss or life. Or if it's a place, I prefer to refer to the forest or the dunes rather than this very container word, nature.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I feel slightly caught out there. I mean, I'd like to talk about that a little later as well, about the separation between ourselves and the natural world around us. But before we get too much deeper into that right now, I'd also really like to talk about drinkable rivers, just the name drinkable rivers. When I first read that, I thought two things. I mean, it's a great title, but it's also a slightly foreign concept. And when I first read it, you know, it just seemed like a kind of a wild idea. You know, we see a lot of images of polluted, clogged up waterways full of plastic and other waste. And the idea that it would be possible to drink from these rivers, you know, it seems almost mythical, but you're working towards making that possible, right? Rivers that we can drink from.
Yeah, that's what we're working on. And can I ask then, what emotion does it give that you realize that it has become almost mythical to hear drinkable rivers?
Well, I think it's a combination of an element of disbelief, honestly, and also hope. It's a combination of those two things.
Because a writer that has just been starting to read our book said, I was shocked at my emotion of a disbelief or as a foreign idea. So he was shocked about this emotion of what you just describe about sort of a disbelief, like, oh, that's impossible, sort of. Like, wow, how deeply pollution is now normalized, ingrained.
Yeah. I'd be really interested to hear just a little bit from you about how you set about what sounds and reads like a monumental task.
So we work towards a world with drinkable rivers with the idea that if we have a world with drinkable rivers, again, it will show us that we live healthy and in balance. And in order to get there, it will require everybody with all their actions every day to contribute, to be aligned with the health of the river, with the logic of the river. And so it's a bit the principle, take care of what takes care of us. If we take care of our base, in this case, water, If the water is okay, it will mean that our soils are healthy, that our air is healthy, that our species richness is again thriving, that our climate is stabilized. It can't be a drinkable river if it doesn't have all that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the drinkable river, we are inviting everybody as inhabitants of a place and different companies to adopt the compass of a drinkable river, that it can guide us with aligning our choices in what do we allow, what materials do we use, does this help towards a drinkable river or not.
Mm-hmm.
So recently we set up a foundation where we are organizing river walks. During these river walks, we mobilize people by raising their awareness and putting them into actions, giving a perspective for them to act. And while we walk, we do citizen science measurement. We also invite others to do citizen science measurement. We have now a community of 60 organizations in 20 countries who have adopted that toolkit, and we designed our own platform. And we hope that these walks create a momentum for action communities to continue to be there. So for instance, I walked the river Meuse. That was the river that has fed me with drinking water all my youth. And I walked from France to the North Sea. Mm-hmm. And I met many people along the way. And one of the people I met were all these Meuse mayors that are part of the river. And we stayed in touch and we created a Mayors for a Drinkable Meuse. And that's a watershed action community.
I mean, first of all, wonderful, really. I read about that as well in your book. And it's one of those stories that genuinely warms the heart and offers a sense of perspective, of hope. I suppose one of the questions that's going around in my mind, again, going back to the many things that I have read over a period of a lot of years of factories that dump their wastewater into rivers, people who throw their rubbish into rivers. There seems to be a collective understanding that rivers are there to be used as toilets, that you can flush the river and then it's all gone somehow. So when you're working with a group of mayors, so in this case, is the idea then to introduce regulations that industry has to adhere to? Or how do you get like all the players that need to be on board to come on board? I mean, it's a hugely collective action, right, to make this work.
Yeah, so I take the metaphor of our walk quite literally here as well, to go step by step, that every step in the right direction. At now, the past 10 years, walking along rivers, I walked 18,500 kilometers and met hundreds of farmers, hundreds of mayors, thousands of children. And so, but how it went was step by step. So this is very much the way we're approaching with Mayors for Drinkable Meuse as well. So it's with the coalition of the willing. So it's not immediately with a big crowd, but happy with the first ones. And we got, for instance, a French mayor, a mayor from Belgium, from Wallonia, and a Dutch mayor to be the founder mayors. And now besides mayors and aldermen from different municipalities from the three countries, also side rivers start to become present. So the Semois, the Gueule, the Gère, and the Domont. So you see that it starts to grow. And same with action. We started with like a declaration. So Mayors for a Drinkable Meuse. So not only connecting the mayors, but having the direction in the name. It says, the Meuse is our lifeline. We're all dependent on this river. The drinkable Meuse will help us guide our individual and collective actions. And we are committing to a first step and to continue following up with next steps. And I leave it open like that because I want it to start becoming part of you. So with inhabitants, I often say like, well, what makes your heart sing? And to start there, for instance, if it's cooking, okay, with what am I cooking? What are my ingredients? Where are they coming from? How did they grow? Do I know the farmers? Is it in season? How local is it? How many chemicals were used to produce it? How many animals were used? You know, so you start to imagine like, okay, taking care of a world with drinkable river, I want at least chemicals. I want as least mileage that it has had. I want it seasonal. I want the packaging as least as possible. So you start to grow rather than that I give a whole list, because that list is dauntingly endless then, but that you start to get invited into it. And you start to feel the joy also of discovering new pathways. And when you love that, you start to spread it. So you're like, oh, I discovered this. And you tell it to your neighbor and your friends. And certain things start to feel more logical. Mm-hmm. And that's what I believe in and what I see with the mayors as well. If I don't prescribe, per se, what they need to do, they will be invited continuously in it.
That's really nicely put, actually. And I very much like this question, what makes your heart sing? I think that's such an invitation for people.
Yeah, and it's very important that we are alive and that we like it, that we are enthusiastic. So despite hope and despair, to choose to be enthusiastic, to whatever you have to give and to receive, that's what you do. And so to be having that compass first, your singing heart will help to pursue a larger compass like a drinkable river.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, going back to what we talked about before, and you asked the response to this idea that rivers could be drinkable. We see these images. We know that rivers are very often polluted. Yet in many countries, we turn on the tap and clean water comes out. And I guess I question, how do you, in the minds of people who are just so used to going and turning on the tap, that maybe they're like, I don't even need to really care because maybe the river's polluted, but it doesn't matter because I've got my clean water anyway. How do you get beyond what seems to be like a functioning reality?
Yeah, there's not per se one strategy of how I do that. It's also to really feel where are people at that time. So to make people aware that it's already a privilege to drink from the tap, and then to make people aware that to make that tap water, how many millions, if not even more than that, kilometers of pipelines is needed, and pumps and all the processes to keep all the things out. For instance, these substances we can't see, like the PFAS, the microplastics, medicine residue. And even though we have very good drinking water, 20% of these substances of high risk, we cannot take out. So it's also making people aware of that data, and that people have been finding microplastics in breast milk and even in baby blood. So then it's very close.
Yeah.
Those are some ways to bridge it. And sometimes it's more inviting people to come and join our walk and be with the water and let them experience water in a very different way.
Yeah.
I ask people about their water biographies, you know, what are your favorite memories with water, and where did you grow up? What water was close to you? What is your current drinking water? Where's it coming from? What's the source, and where's it going to? And things like that, to put them also in their own water cycle that we're all part of. And then the fascination of water grows through that kind of experience and invitation with these questions.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, yeah, it's not so for granted anymore.
It's really tapping into the power of human imagination as well, right? Inviting people to reacquaint themselves with their own imagination. One question that I was asking myself is, if the instinctive response to the idea of clean water in rivers is so foreign, then does that also imply a sense of feeling that there's no agency to change things, that it's just that is the way it is? So what can I do about it?
I think that could be part of it, yeah. There's a few things. I think that our experiences with too much water, that we have had some traumas in the past with floodings, for instance. So turning our backs towards the river, that has been a tendency in many places around the world. And another element was that because we started to more and more have professionals to take care of it, like we're now also so much dependent on the whole food system to feed ourselves. There is, I think, an element that when it's professionalized, this sense of agency or responsibility moves away from us. And so indeed, to show us how we are part of this water cycle, whether we want it or not. We are participating with everything we do and with everything we're dressed and with everything we eat. It needed water to get to us, and it will in many ways affect our waterways as well. So with water, you also say from you're dependent on those of you upstream, and you're responsible for all those downstream. And even in our mental health, I think to take that agency back and have a perspective to act from will be very healthy, actually. Mm-hmm. Raising awareness, it works to a certain degree, but if it reaches a point where you could become quite aware, it is very depressing. And so I do also think weaving agency then within it and affirming that every action, every one matters, yeah, that it is also healing to realize that.
Absolutely. I think we need to be inspired to feel that there is something worth working towards and mucking in and doing our bit, however small. It gives a very different feeling, doesn't it? As you say, not sitting around just absorbing information that can pull you down. In terms of your river walk, so you've just finished walking along the River Thames. I have to say, I was a little envious. I would have loved to walk along the River Thames with you from source to sea. Is it, you know, some people, when they're raising awareness, they go out with big plastic bags and they pull all the rubbish out of the rivers, and you walk along and you clearly meet other people along the way, you have conversations, you're raising awareness. And from the outside perspective, it seems like a very peaceful form of protest, almost a kind of togetherness with the water. How would you describe it?
I see myself as a watershed mobilizer, and that's also what I tell people. So putting people into action, making them aware of how we're all linked as this river family, and also showing that if we tap into that potential that the river family offers, you know, if all wild swimmers and rowers and people who are walking their dogs and people who are living there and the teachers who are participating within the, see, if we are all joining as this river family and saying what we want, then the political will become a derivative of that. Same like our economy. But so often we also there, we have that agency turned around and we think about, oh, the political will and it's far away and our economy. They become these big powers, whereas we forget how it starts from us. Mm-hmm. So a river also, drip by drip, side river with side river, they form the mainstream, they form the big. And that's also what we can start to realize. And that's what we really indeed hope. But I'm not calling it a protest. I'm not calling myself an activist. I am calling myself a mobilizer, wanting to get us into to move into a shared direction. Mm-hmm. We have the parameters to evaluate when it's an ecologically healthy river, which is a drinkable river. And with the Thames, we came at a time when it's so much in the news. And many people we met were angry, mainly with Thames water, who is now spilling 300,000 spills a year and even dry spills. And after 3 days meeting already a few angry people, I started to see the productivity of that emotion in the sense that it raises the aqua literacy. We are more than ever aware how we're dependent on water. It's a shared emotion. And when you are angry, you want it to be changed. But then to have also a positive perspective in what the change you want to see can look like, you have to articulate that as well. Not only we don't want the spills, but you want to have a long-term perspective that captures everybody in that watershed. And so that's what we do. And we're following this up with three different groups, with a group of counselors and community leaders, with citizen science who want to continue doing the citizen science. And the third one is connecting hearts and minds. These are artists and many creative people who do a lot of already community projects that what can we learn in how to speak to our hearts and how to get it into our daily lives, how to invite more people to widen our circles.
I mean, so you don't kind of go do your walk and then come away. You maintain contact with people afterwards as well. So it's quite a holistic, long-term project.
Yeah, I do hope that we are at some point not needed. So that I really invite people to adopt it themselves. But because we have this unique perspective from source to seam, having met so many people, we are now putting them into connection with each other. We see priorities. So in that sense, we stay connected where needed.
And do you think, I mean, there have been, obviously over the last couple of years, prolonged periods of drought have had a big impact on some major European waterways. Have you noticed any change in people's perceptions of rivers around those droughts?
Yeah, so when we were talking about taking things for granted and we were relating to the tap water, I think this is a very important element that is now part much more of how we have been experiencing water in our daily lives, to see that it's not something for granted. Having, the past 5 years, four very warm, hot, dry summers and one very wet summer, we're starting to see how climate destabilization is already here. And now we start to realize that we have to capture water and let it more infiltrate into our soils and to feed our groundwater levels again, to be more resilient in times when there's not enough water available, to become more sponge landscapes, sponge cities, where we buffer more. And now we start to see water is the base of everything. So if we take that in our decision making, whether it's designing new buildings or whatever, actually, if that is then the basis, then all the other things that come after that will be informed and will not break that pattern of taking care of what takes care of us.
Which leads on to something else I want to talk to you about, which now I have to watch my phrasing carefully, because I want to talk about the non-human world around us. And in your book, also, you reference deep ecology and our kind of inherent connection to the non-human environment. And, you know, one could be forgiven for concluding that in sort of the vortex of modern consumer society, that a good degree of that connection has at least been, if not forgotten, just been smothered by other interests and other perceived needs.
Yeah.
And I wonder what you feel about the importance of connection to the non-human world around us.
Yeah, I see. So everything I do with these river walks, but also teaching, it's always outside and making us more part. So with deep ecology, it's also about broadening our self-identification, that it's not only with our ego stories or our human stories, but that it can broaden out. Yeah. And it happens automatically when being outside already. You know, we're not controlling the light. We're not controlling wind and temperature. And you are immersed. You are part, whether you are actively or consciously participating within it. But yeah. And it's very different when having a conversation, making decisions, teaching indoors where everything is controlled. I do invite a lot of decision makers to make important decisions, make them outside, close to water, with a child, preferably with you, so that you phrase it as simple and understandable that the child can understand. And also, can you look the children into the eye with your decision and be informed with the consequences that it will have beyond that child for the soil, the water, the air, all the living beings? Because then to realize that the drinkable river, even though it's down so far away for us in our imagination, for many of our plants, our trees and our water larvae and fish and birds and even the dogs that that take on walks or the cows we have in the fields for us, it's a reality. They already drink from the river.
I absolutely love the idea of inviting decision makers to go outside with a child, look them in the eye. I heard you speaking also about us human beings. We're like around 60% water. And, you know, I've read various things over the years as well about this, why it is that we love to be by the water. Why are we so calmed by walking along a lake or walking along the beach? This connection that we have, which my understanding is that the connection is because so much of us is actually water. But if that is such an innate part of us, you know, then I wonder, how can we tap into that in order to benefit not only the environment, but also our physical, our own physical and mental well-being? Have you got some tips for people who might be looking for a quick way to embark on that journey of reconnecting?
Yeah. So very much it resonates what you say. And so I think one, it's not easy, and yet it is easy. So I learned this also from Mona Bolak, an indigenous woman from Arizona. And she said, thank water before using, whether it's flushing the toilet, washing our hands, washing our face, taking a shower, taking a cup of tea. There's so many moments to thank water. That is a small tip that I could give. Another, of course, is spend time outside and not only doing it functionally, also these other things like what makes your heart sing, and to see whatever that answer is, how is that dependent on water and what effect does it have on water? Yeah, to deepen this explicit conscious way of participation. And then you can also, the products that you're using, maybe call them one time and see like what is your climate strategy and how many chemicals are you using in the process, things like that. You are showing them that you care as well. You heard me say briefly the sentence like, I don't call our walks a protest or myself an activist. It's very much wanting to take care of what takes care of us and normalize that more and not make that as if that makes you an activist. Like, yeah, no, polluting that, to see like working against, say, our natural systems and our the logic of life, how that can undermine life, that actually, that you look at that more like, that's bizarre.
Okay, well, that's some pretty good tips. The very final question, which again, this is something that I put to everybody. If there were just a single skill that you wish everybody had, what would it be?
I think what we learn from children, like this persistent curiosity.
That's a nice one.
You know, that children ask so many questions, like why, that at some point I realized, oh yeah, I'm answering these questions to my nephews, but what if I follow them? Where are they inviting me into? So rather than answering them, I was joining them in questions. And yeah, do that and you'll discover different ways of being. And I think when we're in that state, you know, then we do wonder, why do I brush my teeth with microplastics? But in a way, not only of being frustrated by it, but also like, that's not what I want. And that there must be other ways. And I think that curiosity is then a quality.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for all these really very enlightening and interesting answers. And also just for taking the time to come and talk to me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for inviting. Likewise.
I did ask Leanne to let me know if she's coming to a river near me anytime soon. But in the meantime, I have plenty to reflect upon and to remind me not to take the water that comes out of my taps or which is present in my food for granted. And also to consider the journey that the water has undertaken to reach me. I'll be back next month with a new episode of the Inner Green Deal podcast. For now, though, I invite you to share, subscribe, or scroll through the archives, which contain many interesting conversations with people working on sustainability and inner development. And I look forward to you joining me again very soon. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.